From the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, this is Voices of Public Intellectuals. I'm your host, Florence Ladd. This week's program features Rita Nakashima Brock, director of the Bunting Fellowship Program and co-author of Casting Stones, Understanding Prostitution in Asia. Today, Dr. Brock addresses the topic, Facing Our Demons and Our Angels, the Role of Religious Commitment in the Practice of Democracy. Here to introduce Dr. Brock is Acting Dean of the Radcliffe Institute, Mary Maples Dunn.
I'm delighted to welcome you to this evening's lecture by Rita Nakashima Brock, who, as I think most of you know, is the director of the Bunting Fellowship Program here at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. Now, Rita holds a PhD from the Claremont Graduate University and has taught in the religion departments of a number of colleges and universities. But I would like to say a word about her childhood, which I think isn't the ordinary substance of an academic introduction. But Rita was born in Fukuoka, Japan, to a Japanese mother and an American father who was Puerto Rican. She came to the United States only when she was six. So she brings to us a special kind of sensibility, I think, and sensitivity to issues particularly of race and ethnicity. She is a prize-bedecked author. Her Journeys by Heart, A Christology of Erotic Power, won the 1988 Crossroads Continuum Press Award for the most outstanding manuscript in women's studies. And Casting Stones, Understanding Prostitution in Asia and the United States, won the Catholic Press Award in Gender Studies for 1997. In 1994, the Associated Religious Press gave her their award for excellence in theological reflection for the published version of her 1993 Reimagining Conference keynote lecture entitled On Mirrors, Mother Root, and Memory. This lecture was so noted that she ended up on Ted Koppel's Nightline to defend feminist theology against conservative religious attack, and I'd be willing to bet I know who won. It's a very great pleasure to introduce my distinguished colleague, and I look forward to her help in facing my demons and angels. I know she will be both provocative and stimulating. So please welcome Rita Nakashima Brock.
I have chosen the vexing problem for democracy and for feminism of religion to conclude this series. I was unwittingly dragged into this issue of religion at the age of six, as Mary mentioned, when I was brought from Japan to the United States. This was not an easy journey. My Puerto Rican father left my mother when I was 6 months old and was sent to Korea. My parents weren't married, and my mother heard nothing from him for 2 years. In that time, I was raised in my Buddhist grandparents' home. My mother eventually met and married another GI named Roy from rural Mississippi, who was legally unable to adopt me at the time. Roy received transfer orders to the United States when I was four. The Immigration and Naturalization Service, beloved by many of us, refused to let me accompany my mother because I was not Roy's legally adopted daughter. Roy appealed repeatedly. After a series of denials by the INS, he requested an alternative assignment in Okinawa where I could accompany my parents. During the year we spent in Okinawa, Roy continued his appeals to the INS, all denied. Finally, he turned to his senator for help. In order to clear my entry into the U.S., Roy had to sign an affidavit in which he pledged to raise me as a loyal American citizen and as a good Christian. He signed. I arrived in the U.S. as a child of parents from two different races and two different religions, pledged to become a Christian. My parents, to honor the affidavit my father had signed, tried to make me as American as possible. I was not to speak Japanese. I was raised in white liberal Protestantism. Roy, whose family in Mississippi was Southern Baptist, rejected that tradition when he joined the Army. To Southern Baptists, being a heretic was to be a Methodist. Somebody's a Southerner, yeah. So Methodist was what he claimed to be on his enlistment papers, though I doubt he had a clue what a Methodist was, except not a Baptist. In any case, he took my religious upbringing seriously. Perhaps as a consequence, I have become a scholar of religion, and especially of Christianity. Each of the three words that are the subject of this lecture, feminism, democracy, and religion, has produced entire libraries of materials. None of the terms can be used uncritically as if their meanings were self-evident. I will begin by describing how I am using the term religion, since this is a key issue in my lecture. As an illustration of what I mean, I will use the example of Native American religions to show how the U.S. Constitution assumes the religion of Christianity, which it imposes on other groups. Because Christianity has been the dominant religion of the United States, I will show how Christian churches have also been important to the practice of democracy in several ways. Christianity is also a major reason American democracy is gendered and discriminates against women. I will examine the problem of Christianity in relation to marriage and sex, which are core places of difficulty for women under U.S. law. Of course, women have not stood still for sexist treatment under the law or by religion, but have found ways to use Christianity as a major motivation to argue for dignity and equality of rights, and this too I will examine. And finally, in the last part of this lecture, I will discuss how we might think again about the relationship among feminism, democracy, and religion. So let me begin with the term religion. Religion was self-evident to the writers of the Constitution when they set up the divide between church and state, but it is no longer self-evident to scholars of religion, especially those who study the vast variety of human behaviors called religious. Is religion belief in something transcendent, such as God? Or is it the community rituals and behaviors people regularly engage in, that is, how they demonstrate belonging to a circle of kinship and ancestors, such as Shinto? Is it belief at all, or largely community practice? Does it require a god or gods, which is basically an irrelevant question to Buddhism? Is it subjective and private, or a product of our social natures usually engaged in unreflectively? These are not settled questions for scholars, nor are they settled for people within a religious tradition. How various people belong to their religious traditions is often hotly contested. For example, in Christianity, Orthodox, fundamentalist, liberal, feminist, evangelical, and other variations make claims to being an authentic form, or even the authentic form, of Christianity. In the American practice of democracy, the term religion has been used relatively uncritically. And because it has been used uncritically, a set of unquestioned assumptions about religion have been at work. These assumptions come from the default definition we inherited from Europe. This default definition is what I call a religious grammar. A religious grammar is a system of living that carries unexamined assumptions about reality. A grammar is enacted in a variety of ways. For example, through rituals such as holiday celebrations. through structures and rules, such as the arrangements of space or definitions of what is considered antisocial or offensive behavior, through kinds of language we use, through forms of visual, audio, and kinesthetic art, and through our unquestioned attitudes and feelings. American civil and legal definitions of religion assume an implicit grammar inherited from the Western Enlightenment, which was shaped by Protestant Christianity. This grammar is the basis of the American guarantee of the free exercise of religion without the establishment of a state religion. The separation of church and state assumes two distinct realms, a religious one above, governed by God, and a secular one below, governed by the state. In this hierarchical dualism, the spiritual realm of God, which is holy, infinite, and perfect, is understood to be distinct and dissimilar from the profane world, which is corrupt, finite, and defiling. The two realms are in tension with each other because of their conflicting values. This dualistic and hierarchical splitting of the cosmos is characteristic of most Christian grammars, but it is especially pronounced in Protestantism, which also, more than any other Christian movement, reduced religion to individual subjectivity by centering it on faith and ideas about God. The Constitution distinguishes the profane realm as the realm of the secular state. The framers of the Constitution may or may not have been believers in religion themselves, but when they speak of religion, they use the grammar of European Protestant Christianity. One of the largely unquestioned creeds of American politics is the constitutional prohibition of state-imposed religion and the separation of church and state. Regardless of whether one is religious or not, the constitutional separation of church and state may seem convenient and helpful for maximizing religious freedom for all Americans. But the capacity to separate the two is made possible by a Protestant grammar. While the law prohibits the explicit state imposition of religion, Protestantism found its way in the back door of democracy by being the religious grammar of the Constitution, and this has been a problem for Native Americans. The U.S. government has regularly violated Native American religious liberty through the devastation of natural places regarded as sacred by tribal groups, through the removal of people from their traditional sacred lands, and through the Christianization and assimilation of Indian nations by forced attendance at Christian boarding schools and forced adoption of Indian children into white families. The denial of religious liberty and human rights here is larger than the question of who owns what or how much the state can interfere in the free exercise of religion. We are looking at different religious grammars, with one being imposed on the other as superior. Protestantism emphasizes faith, the freedom of which it is much easier to guarantee than the free practice of religion. Christian belief or faith in God is abstract, while Native American practice involves the material world. Unlike Christians, Native Americans do not split the spiritual into a separate realm or place it above material reality. Belief is secondary to practice because one's location and behavior is what determines one's place in circles of kinship, ancestry, community, and cosmos. The spiritual is revealed in the natural world, in the flow of events, and in the particular cluster of human relationships that place one in a distinct and knowable universe. Individual subjectivity matters far less than the maintenance of life-supporting systems. The sacred cannot be found elsewhere. The sacred is experienced in relationships and place, rather than needing to be believed in. Christianity is the religion of the separation of church and state, and Christian churches have functioned since the beginning of the Republic as a training ground for participation in American democracy. Churches were often the main meeting ground for public gatherings to discuss political issues, and clergymen who developed their oratory skills in the pulpit were active in political life. The Sunday school movement became a model for public education. The anti-slavery movement had roots in churches, and of course the civil rights movement emerged out of the black church. Churches have been important to immigrant minorities who have come to American shores from outside Europe to acculturate to the dominant society. When Asian immigrants arrived on the West Coast in the 19th century, they modeled their Buddhist temples on Protestant churches to avoid racist persecution. They even called them Buddhist churches. They instituted weekly Sunday services, including Sunday school and hymn singing, practices unheard of in Asia. Church participation taught immigrants the process of voluntary association and through committee work how to organize groups of people. These are practices of democracy. Churches have been a major site of language training, social activism, against racism, labor organizing, economic redistribution of resources, and voter registration. Christian churches in North America have also been important places to many minority women for participation in democracy. Churches provided places for women to learn leadership skills by being church school teachers, elders, and members of church boards, by recruiting volunteers, and by being elected officers in subgroups of the church, such as the Youth League or Women's Society, of which there were many. Churches were often the only place women heard members of their own race and other women like themselves speak in public. The Christian grammar women learn in churches is not, however, without serious drawbacks. When women practice their leadership and organizing skills in the church, they often do so at odds with much of the gender ideology of the church, which preaches submissiveness. This is because the Protestant Christian grammar of gender is deeply rooted in the subordination of women that continues to affect Christian church practices and the practice of democracy. A major aspect of that subordination is marriage. American democracy is grounded in Christian assumptions about heterosexual marriage, which in turn is grounded in Christian ideas about women's role, sexuality, and proper behavior. Protestant gender assumptions subordinate women based on their relationships to men. I say Protestant not because I think other forms of Christianity are less patriarchal, but because Protestantism especially confines women to the domestic sphere. And Protestantism is more closely associated with the Enlightenment ideas that form our Constitution. Before the Protestant Reformation, women had the opportunity for education and leadership through taking holy orders in convents, which also allowed them to avoid marriage. Protestants abolished holy orders because they refused to concede that Christians could earn divine grace by taking holy orders. The removal of holy orders did not mean Protestants thought more highly of women or sex. In fact, Protestants differed very little in a negative attitude toward sex, which is symbolized by women as a sign of the flesh. In this, Protestants simply follow the grammar of Augustine from the 4th century. Augustine, one of the great architects of this theology, staked the root of original sin in sexual lust. He based this theory on his own experience of what he calls his unruly member. I think this is a rather unreliable instrument upon which to erect a theological structure. The very unruliness of his member convinced Augustine that elements of human behavior were not under the control of the rational moral will, which was a sign that sin was intractable and unavoidable. Augustine's phallocentric theory of lust and sin has held great sway in Western Christianity. Women, as the object of desire and symbol of the corrupting powers of the flesh, were both subordinated and demonized. Given the current debate about gay marriage, it is interesting to note that Augustine laments that he could not have in his sexual relationships with women the kind of intellectual and emotional intimacy he had with his close male friends. I hope you see the Christian grammar operating here. The higher spiritual realm has intellectual and emotional intimacy and friendship. The profane realm has sin and lust, which is what women represent. This split demonizes women's sexuality and elevates abstinence and celibacy to a higher spiritual state. The institution of marriage troubled many of the early church fathers, not just Augustine, for interesting reasons. Sexual relations and marriage were highly political in imperial Rome, as scholar Peter Brown notes. Disease, ceaseless war making, and a high infant mortality rate meant the Roman government had to make sure every female had at least 5 children before she died to keep the population from shrinking. Life expectancy was 25 years old. Only 3% of adults lived beyond the age of 40. Full legal marriage was reserved for citizens and expected of every Roman as a state responsibility to enhance reproduction. Slaves were denied it because they could be forced to reproduce as labor needs required. Daughters of Roman citizens were married early, usually at the onset of puberty, to older men who could provide for them. Roman state marriage politics made the first Christians uncomfortable with matrimony. Early Christianity attracted large numbers of followers among those outside Roman citizenship. The decision not to marry, or the decision within marriage to abstain from sexual relations, were regarded by Christians as acts against Roman polytheism and its state tyranny. Thus, sexual abstinence came to be seen as a higher religious and political calling for these first Christians. Chastity was expected of women, who were responsible for controlling male sexual behavior since men were seen as unable to control themselves. As a form of control, however, chastity also gave spiritual autonomy and social and church power to Christian women who chose that route. Given these ambiguities and complexities regarding marriage, for many centuries, the Western Christian Church did not view matrimony as sacred and had no formal or regular ceremonies for it. In fact, they didn't have any ceremonies for over a millennium. The early Christian fathers associated marriage with the tyrannical power of the state and the violence done to their people under Roman power. In separating themselves from the powers of this world, this is a term they used to describe the political, military, religious, and economic system that dominated their lives under Rome, Christians chose to believe in another power, a realm not under the rule of the Roman Empire. They adopted an alternative vision of life they called the Basileia, or the reign of God, which deserved their allegiance because it gave them a point of resistance to tyranny. The institution of marriage troubled the early church fathers because it was associated with oppression and tyranny. And there is clear evidence that early on, women from a variety of groups and social classes were attracted to Christianity because of its vision of a community of equals. In this ancient context, the sectarian decision to reject the Roman imposition of church and state provided Christians breathing space by offering an alternative set of values. These values were imagined theologically and enacted in rituals of community separate from state tyranny. And sexually separate, celibate communities of Christians carried forward this vision of a different life for many centuries. But these communities also carried forward the Augustinian grammar of women and sex. And as I said a few minutes ago, the Protestant reformers maintained these views of women and sex. They were no better. Calvin thought marital sex was all right for procreative purposes. But one had to be careful not to turn the marriage bed into a nest of licentiousness. In other words, one could have sex, but one should not enjoy it. Before we leave the subject entirely, we ought to consider what more ascetic forms of sex and marriage might mean in a time when birth control was unheard of and too many pregnancies endangered maternal health. Men were encouraged to weigh the responsibility of fatherhood against a few moments of pleasure. Under Protestantism, Christian women could no longer avoid the necessity of marriage since women had lost the option of a convent and holy orders. And once married, women forfeited all rights to make independent moral decisions about sex since they legally belonged to their husbands. This Western Christian grammar of heterosexual sexuality, inherited from the early church fathers, and a grammar of marriage, inherited from the Protestant reformers, provides the assumptions about women that ground the U.S. Constitution. Marriage is a major problem in women's full citizenship and participation in American democracy. Heterosexual relationships in general are defined by marriage, which is structured according to power control and the exchange of sex within economic arrangements. Our marriage laws were set up historically in such terms, with women given the status of property. Since marriage defined women as non-citizens, we were, in Elizabeth Cady Stanton's words, legally dead. Marriage is a major point at which religion and the state collude in power against women. The ceremonial phrase used at weddings, "by the power vested in me, I now pronounce you husband and wife," and the clergy signature on the license are ways religious authorities act on behalf of the state with state authorization. While today's marriage laws have been reformed to give women more rights, the state continues to have a vested interest in marriage. Same-sex relationships challenge the power relationships of heterosexuality. But if they were granted the same legal status as marriage, they would also reintroduce some of the other interests of the state in marriage. This is because marriage remains an institution governed by economic arrangements, and it continues to be the major institution by which states enforce social welfare policies and receive unpaid labor in caring for its citizens and children. Like other aspects of the nonprofit economy, including religion, the state receives enormous benefits in the care of the sick, the dying, the young, and the elderly through the social structure of marriage. Marriage benefits the bottom line of both the state and the corporation.
You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Rita Nakashima Brock.